Yeah, this is more fun for me to be in the station. You know, my picture of a radio station are these hanging mics.
Okay. Reminds me of going to see a therapist. It's like going into that sacred healing space.
Ah.
40 years ago, I used to go for kind of like primal / rebirth sessions. And after a few sessions, I would just go into the room, lie down, and it would start happening all by itself.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You were conditioned.
I was conditioned, yeah. So I thought I would open with a quote from one of your articles. I think this is from William Stanley. Newtonian physics implied the universe was a vast machine. The quantum model showed there is no machine, but a mysterious entanglement with the observer. The area of preparation must now include the participant observer. Newtonian physics suggested an end to free will and creativity. The quantum model put the observer back in the universe as a participant creator. In Newton's world, ambiguity was the enemy. Mechanism stresses the absolute, the unchanging, and the certain. Things are either or, good, bad. In the quantum world, reality is both and. A coexistence of mutually contradictory possibilities, all equally true, each one a potentially possible constituent of reality. Acausal, non-local synchronicities can give rise to events that seem to pop up out of thin air. There are no isolated, separate, closed systems in nature. In this universe of wholeness, everything affects everything else, from the most fundamental particles to faraway galaxies at the edge of the universe.
Wow. Well, need I say anything more?
Well, yeah. I would really like to know how you got into nonlinear science and how you integrate this into your work. That, to me, is really fascinating.
Oh, you said you like to go deep, and you're jumping there right at the very beginning here.
Well, I like to set the tone.
Okay. How did I get into it? Actually, I think that's the Feynman story. When I went to graduate school at UCLA, I did a dissertation in depression, and I really don't like depression. I didn't have any interest in what I did, and it was really just to get out of there. Then I had this early life crisis when I got out because I wasn't sure what I was interested in. And when I got interested in creativity, I then put something in to teach a course at UCLA Extension as a way of learning about creativity. I, through that process, wound up being asked to moderate this huge course, which scared me to death because I didn't feel qualified at all. I was a merely student who didn't know anything about creativity. But in the process, it opened all these doors. And one of these doors was the psychiatrist Oscar Janiger, who fed LSD to artists in the 60s and had never told anyone about it professionally because he was teaching at Irvine and he wanted to remain respectable. So I wound up in a drawing session with Richard Feynman, and we would meet weekly, and I realized that I had the opportunity to pick the brain of reputedly the smartest man in the world, and I started to read all about science at that point and kind of stumbled into nonlinear science, which was really kind of coming to the forefront at the time. So that's how I got into it.
So what really interested you about it, and how did you end up integrating into your psychotherapy work?
You know, I think I've always been intuitively drawn, that there's just something hums inside me, something zings inside me when I find profundity. But I think what part of what you read about paradox is one of the most interesting things to me. There's something very deep about it. Maybe it's having read Coens and this sort of thing and having a spiritual sense that this is the path to enlightenment. And Alan Watts, I used to love Alan Watts and speak about the radio. And so just the sense that there's something very, very deep about this path. And it's away from logic. There's something feels sterile about logic. And when you do therapy, there's nothing sterile about it at all. It's messy and it's ambiguous. It's everything that you read in that quote. It's filled with complexity. It's filled with mystery. So the sides had the same kinds of feeling tones to me as therapy does.
So how do you deal with all that complexity and ambiguity and messiness in your therapy work with clients?
Well, I definitely don't try to fix people.
That's convenient.
It's very convenient. And I come at it more from the position of a voyeur than an earth mother. And that's helpful too. I'm really fascinated. And also, my husband likes to say that my power as a therapist is in really empowering people and having this sort of relentless hope and positivity. So I don't tend to diagnose and pathologize, and I am very good at finding progress in tiny little spaces. And once you find the progress, if you verbalize it, it tends to build on itself. So that helps people change quickly.
So do you find that that has an infectious effect on your clients?
I think I'm an inspirational therapist. People feel inspired by my energy and focus and this sort of thing. And then, yeah, everything is contagious.
So it sounds like you have this ability to see like these pinpricks of light in the darkness.
Exactly, yeah.
And then somehow your sense of optimism and hope feeds it.
Right.
And you connect to it.
Right.
And you kind of nurture that in that healing space right. with your clients.
I think that's right. And that's a beautiful way of verbalizing it.
I just love that approach, which is mm-hmm. exactly why I would love to have you as my therapist, you know, at least just for the fun of it.
Oh, yeah. It is fun. I also like to laugh.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
You talk a lot about humor and creativity and play in your work.
Right.
And how do you bring those into your psychotherapy work when you have clients who come in who are bringing their problems and their issues? And often they're not even clear about what their problems are. And you're kind of in this space of unknowing.
Uh-huh.
And you have the responsibility of trying to figure out what's going on, doing your sleuthing and all that.
Sometimes humor is a way of gaining perspective. It's also a way of joining with a person to gain perspective and being on the same side. And I'm not talking about sarcastic humor because that doesn't work at all. Although I don't have rules like that because even every rule does get broken too. So there's probably a place for sarcasm. But I think play makes it safe for people also. Children learn the most through play. They find their cutting edge in play. And there are no consequences, so people can play with new possibilities and feel safe about doing that. It lightens up the dark, and it helps to not take oneself too seriously. I think that also can work well.
So is play something that you do in your therapy work, or is it something that arises spontaneously?
It arises spontaneously, and I am not a play therapist, and I don't work with children, so it's really at an implicit level that play happens, not so much an explicit level.
And is it something that you're aware is happening, or is it something that you only recognize in retrospect?
Probably more in retrospect, yeah.
So I'm curious, if it's happening implicitly, are you just like playing into the play in the moment with your client?
That's a good way of putting it.
Because you talk a lot about the space between the client mm-hmm. and therapist.
Mm-hmm. Right. So for example, let's say I have somebody who comes in and is more depressed and is stuck somewhere. And it could be really hard. If somebody is really repetitive, could be hard to keep interest. So I keep interest partly by playing with that whole situation. I'm trying to find a way in to shift something. And so I'll just play with entering in different ways. And that feels like a form of play, to see what I can do to help generate something different and get some movement happening. So it's almost like playing with ideas sometimes. And that would be a situation where I'm almost playing with myself more, mm-hmm. you know, and in an effort to connect in a different way and draw the person into play or into taking a risk emotionally or something like that.
So you're really exploring relationship with the person.
Oh, definitely. This is all relational play. And I think play at the implicit level is like a relational bid for connection or disconnection, and often a statement of safety or lack of safety. And so I kind of listen between the words to find that feeling, which is really about the relationship and what's needed. Some people need me to come in and try to connect in a sort of aggressive way. Some people need me to stand back because they've been intruded upon or they've been violated, and they need to know I can take care of myself. If they have horrible stuff to say, that I won't get too affected by it, or this sort of thing. So there's all this implicit messaging back and forth that most of it's not conscious. It's all not conscious, and some of it trickles up to consciousness.
That's so fascinating. I was going to ask you, how do you know which way to go? But then you just said that a lot of it's happening unconsciously.
Yeah, the body knows. It's weird.
The body knows. So talk about how the body knows.
Because the unconscious is in the body. I think Freud started out at the very disembodied place where he wasn't looking at his patients. They weren't looking at him. He's sitting away and he's just listening as if kind of the words are floating and nobody has any bodies. Mm-hmm. But even there. So I think we got this initial sense of the unconscious being in the head mm-hmm. somehow. But it's not. It's in the body. It's in the implicit movement and processing that happens underneath awareness, which is most of what we process. And awareness is sort of like the icing on the cake that gives us the illusion that we have some control over what's happening. But it's after the fact.
So psychotherapy work, isn't it the work of bringing that implicit, unconscious stuff into the light of awareness and making it explicit?
No, actually, not necessarily. Not necessarily. Because that's a really common fallacy, as if there's sort of one chain or something from unconscious to conscious. But they're two separate ones. There's an implicit and there's an explicit. Consciousness is in the explicit. Some people get healed without ever being explicit about it. Like children, for example, may not have to verbalize what's happening at all. But if the relationship is healed, and if they become more secure in it, and they become more secure with themselves and more connected to their own intuition and their own instincts, they don't need to be self-conscious about it, have conscious awareness of that process. Most people in therapy do, but it isn't converting one to the other. It's really, that's a relational process too. The relationship between the explicit and the implicit is another level. It's like a self-self relations.
So they're not separate things.
They are separate things. But, and you have to bridge them with... They may be, they may not be. They, you know, some people have a real split between conscious and unconscious, a real split.
And is that kind of a split unhealthy, or is
unhealthy,
that?
It's unhealthy. Okay. Yeah, it's unhealthy.
I guess that's what I was alluding to. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you need, you know, the more we can bridge that gap with awareness, the healthier we are, certainly as adults. But, you know, if I had to pick one, it's the implicit level that needs to be healed. I mean, that's where
absolutely. Yeah. So you said that you don't necessarily need to bring the implicit into awareness,
right.
But don't we have to go into the implicit? Like the journey of going into the underworld, mythologically? Not that we necessarily need to talk about it.
Most people do. Well, certainly, yeah. We certainly need to dive into our dark side, if mm-hmm. that's what you mean. Yeah, and experience ourselves fully, experience all our emotions and anything that's been repressed or dissociated. Absolutely. But the direct experience is a little different than the awareness of the experience right. or the interpretation of the experience. Yeah. So yeah, we have to dive into ourselves deeply.
So that brings up another fascinating kind of conundrum. When you're doing psychotherapy work with people, you just mentioned the importance is for them to directly experience what's mm-hmm. inside themselves.
Right, rather than to analyze.
And rather than even talking about it necessarily.
Necessarily, right.
How do you deal with that without necessitating them actually talking about things so that you're aware of what they're going through? And how aware of what they're going through do you need to be? Or can you, just through your bodily relationship with them, recognize that they're in that authentic place?
I think different therapists have different levels of skill in feeling out what's happening inside of someone when they're, say, highly emotional or about to become emotional, or a little tiny shifts in the face and the body that indicate a shift in self state. I am actually less skilled than some. In my workshop yesterday, there was a woman who I couldn't believe how skilled she was. I could tell. And of course, after 30 years of practice, I've gotten way more skilled than I was, and I compensate in lots of different ways. But I tend to take information in more from the outside than the inside. And so I'm a little less body connected than some people, and especially somatic workers. And so I do rely more on words, but I know when to ask for words by what's going on. And there's some advantage to the level that I trust people to speak about what's happening. So now I'm violating what I said to you earlier, in the sense that I'm pretty word focused.
But it also fits in with the ambiguity
and
no rules.
Yeah, and the paradox. Yeah. So,
You're still
that's
safe.
That's okay, right. Yeah. I know. See how it's safe to to work with paradox? I can contradict myself.
So it sounds like you allow a lot of space for what you could call as mistakes and momentary failures.
Well, mistakes are great.
In the exploration.
Mistakes are great because when I mess up and I'm non-defensive about it, I'm modeling something that is so important for people. Mm. And actually, that I think being non-defensive is one of my greatest strengths as a therapist. Mm-hmm. If I make an interpretation and someone says that's wrong, I will always back away from pressing. I rarely have the sense that I know more than the person does, although some, you know, again, to any rule, there's an exception. Once in a while, I'll have a sense that something's going on that the person's not yet aware of, but I feel like it's interesting, actually, to help people connect with their unconscious, because it's tricky business to, you know, by the very definition, it's an area of self that is not conscious. So how do you know what's true with something? And so I like to describe it as it's a kind of resonance with it. Like, you'll know if something is wrong. It just won't resonate at all. But it's a sideways kind of feeling, not a frontways feeling of sensing that could be so. And that's all that I would need with something like that. Something could be so, and then let it simmer and see what brews out of that. It's a little bit like peripheral vision, looking at the stars. Mm-hmm. You can see them more clearly than looking straight on when they're faint.
You talk a lot about and write a lot about intuition in your psychotherapy mm-hmm. work. Is that what you're referring to?
Sure. That's definitely an important part of intuition is sensing something might be so and finding where the resonances are.
And how easy is it to trust, to learn to trust our intuition and to actually hear it and feel it and honor it, particularly growing up in this culture of ours?
That's a big topic. I mean, this culture probably does everything to not promote, inadvertently, to not promote tapping into intuition. I have a model for how intuition develops that begins with children having complete space for free play. And I think that's become less and less safe. On the one hand, for parents, they're afraid to. Somebody told me yesterday that parents are being prosecuted for letting their children run free as neglect. That really scares me because I think that kind of freedom in the body and the mind and the soul is really important for coming into oneself, finding oneself. So on the one hand, the sense of danger in the environment is problematic. On the other hand, the sort of virtual play that's happening solely, and I have nothing against that kind of play unless it takes the place of the kind of play that includes the full body. And then on the other hand, there's too much structure going on. When parents structure every minute of their child's life, there's no opportunity to structure one's own time and come up with one's own rules for engagement. And when children do that, where they make the rules for how to play with one another and then internalize that, that's how they learn how to regulate themselves and how to make society.
I want to get back to the element of risk and danger in play and how important that is, because you write about that too. And it also reminded me of one of my favorite interviews from a couple of years ago with Amy Fusselman, who wrote this amazingly wonderful, very small book called Savage Park about these parks that were developed in Scandinavia. And she got to visit one of them in Tokyo with her two small children. Mm-hmm. And these parks are full of inherent risk because children are allowed to do things that most parents in America would just go through the roof about.
Fabulous. What are they allowed to do? Like climb things?
It was a wide open park, and all they had were these attendants in the park to facilitate whatever might need to be done in the park. They didn't do anything other than just be there and make sure that everything was attended to.
Wow.
And children were allowed to do whatever they could get themselves into.
Wow, how fabulous.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what made this book so fascinating. So I would love to hear your perspective on why that's so important in a child's development.
Children navigate by going to edges. They just naturally, do you remember when you were a kid spinning until you fell down?
Well, we're always testing the limits.
Always testing the limits because we learn by crossing lines and all the way through. So that starts in early play where getting dizzy, climbing so high you can't get down.
And often doing things where we fall down and hurt ourselves.
And hurt ourselves,
because that's how we learn how to navigate in physical space.
How to navigate in physical space, but also how to navigate in emotional space. Mm. And how to stretch the window of tolerance, affect tolerance. Because by having some pain mixed in with the pleasure and by not being able to tell the difference between the two, that's how we learn to go to our edges and to risk, which, of course, is necessary at an abstract level for creativity as well.
And doesn't it help to regulate our relationship with our nervous system, our autonomic nervous system? And how does that work? Because that's so critical in a child's development, because that, of course, sets the tone for an adult's ability to function in life and to be self-regulating and to be able to tolerate stress and to be resilient in the face of the unknown and continual change.
That's right. That's right. And arousal is the more important dimension than valence. Mm. In other words, being able to tolerate the intensity of emotion is much more important to a dysregulated or a pathological state than whether the emotion is positive or negative. We all need the full range of emotion, and a lot of people wind up not being able to tolerate intensity. So when children are throwing themselves around and banging and getting hurt, they're learning to tolerate intensity. And that really is where resilience comes from, and the window of tolerance stretching wider and wider, which is a critical dimension to being able to let in novelty and lead an open life to things coming in without defense.
Right. The ability to stay open.
The ability to stay open is probably the most critical dimension.
Because it's not what actually happens out in the world around us that's so important, but how we learn to respond to it.
Right.
And how we
stay open.
Be able to cope with things
right.
in the moment and ultimately to be able to stay present in the face of anything that's occurring.
Exactly.
And that seems to be the goal, if there's such a thing as a goal in psychotherapy work.
That's well put, yeah. Yeah.
And that's the great challenge. And as you mentioned also, to do that emotionally is so, like in relationship, because we're continually being tested on an emotional level in ways that are probably even more challenging than the physical challenges.
Absolutely. And in intimate relations, in our romantic relationships, people don't seem to understand that they're going to be faced with what feels life-shattering and threatening.
Even worse than death itself in many
ways. Yeah. Annihilation.
The worst
potential
kind of
annihilation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so easy to think that because we're feeling that it's the wrong person, but it goes hand in hand with passion, depth. So I've got a couple of different metaphors for what that is like. And one of them is being in an intimate relationship is like hugging a person with one hand and having a knife in the other hand that's to the throat. And each person holds that knife. Shall I say, this is being very, very personal.
Yeah.
But on my own honeymoon, the knife took the form of being afraid I was going to kill my husband.
Oh, okay.
He got sick. We were in Indonesia, and he got sick. So I was going out and playing, and he had a fever. And I realized I was afraid I was going to kill him and that I hadn't gotten in an intimate relationship because the last intimate relationship I had been in, my boyfriend basically went psychotic and never recovered. And I had internalized responsibility for that without realizing that I even felt that way and that I had kept myself out of relationships because of that at some level. There were other reasons too. And boom, that popped up.
Wow. That reminded me of a kind of psychotic relationship I was involved in many, many years ago. Yeah, it's amazing, the dimensions of human relationships
and
experience.
And what comes up, what emerges from the unconscious. So.
And how when two human beings with their own issues come together and start bouncing off of each other.
And guess what he did when I said that to him, that I was afraid I'd kill him? He laughed. And when he laughed, it wasn't a mean laugh. And mm-hmm. it actually completely evaporated that feeling of mine because he had been through so much in his life. And here I was, this little nice thing that he couldn't imagine killing him. And that was the perfect response for me. And I guess actually that sort of says something about a healing power of laughter sometimes.
Yeah. It diffuses
It can the tension. Diffuse the tension, yeah.
And turn the whole perceived situation on its head.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you seem to really love your work.
I do love my work.
And I'm wondering, how have you managed to keep your work fresh and alive and not burn out?
Well, and that's the funny thing is that I think I'm fresher and more alive with it than I've ever been. And it's now I was licensed in 85. And, you know, I think because it's a two-way street, I think that when people transform, I transform too. And it's fascinating to have that happen. So I've never suffered from burnout, and I've never even really tasted it except in a momentary way. And I think maybe because I learn so much and I grow so much from what I do. And also I think the focus on creativity, and that people wind up bringing out their own creativity, whether or not they knew they were coming in for that, because I believe that that's kind of the highest level for everyone, even though I don't mean artistic creativity, but just being able to be new in some way, whether it's how you drive to work or how you teach your class or, you know.
It's like the presence that you bring into each moment.
Exactly. And I like the Ellen Langer way of thinking of mindfulness as opposed to the Jon Kabat-Zinn way of thinking of perceiving novelty.
Mm. So talk about novelty and the importance of novelty. And maybe
back to the nonlinear, because in the nonlinear universe, it changes all the time. Nothing stays the same. There's just an illusion because it's a longer time scale. And so everything is new minute to minute. And it's just our human limitation that gives the illusion of something repeating. So nothing does repeat. And the ability to feel that, I guess, is a good way of striving to embody the true nonlinearity of the universe. And I think if we feel it, there's no room to get bored. I'm an enemy to boredom. I told my kids when they were little that if you're bored, it's because you're boring. And they stop saying they're bored. Mm. I don't think either one of them gets bored. Yeah, and burnout, I think, is an imbalance in someone. There's an imbalance. There's something that is being either enacted from their own issues. Very often it's if a child feels pressure to take care of another member of the family at their own expense, then that becomes a recipe for burning out. Or compassion fatigue is where the emotional dimension of contagion sort of outpaces the cognitive dimension of understanding the world of the other and understanding the differences between self and other in a more cognitive way. So you need a balance there.
So how do you integrate your psychotherapy work into the rest of your life? Because it sounds like you're also a very creative person, and you must have a lot of other things going on in your life. And how much of your life is your psychotherapy work, and how much of your life is other stuff, and how do they come together in a way that feels balanced and enriching for you?
So, yeah, I would say my psychotherapy is kind of the core that keeps grounding me and regrounding me over and over again. But in terms of my week, I've always only practiced 3 days a week, really long days. I start at 7 often and finish at 6, and I never go later than 6. I've started earlier and earlier, but never later. And then I use my other days to, it depends what stage of life that I'm in. I used to rock climb with my other days. I definitely write books. I do my art. Most recently, I'm super excited because next week at Lincoln Center, an opera is playing that I wrote the libretto for. And it's the most complicated performance that Juilliard has ever put on. And I put fractals in the words of the libretto, and the composer, Jonathan Daw, put fractals in the music. And I'm so excited, I'm jumping out of my skin. And that kind of thing, just always, whether it's being pulled or just jumping and or leaping into new places, that also cross-fertilizes back into my work and keeps me fresh from the outside to bring back in. So sometimes I get stimulated from inside the practice, sometimes from outside. I also dance a lot. I dance maybe 4, sometimes 5 times a week. I do ballet and jazz, and that's like a joy factory for me.
So you're taking classes?
Taking classes.
Yeah.
And watching myself learn at my advanced age, watching my process, and I'm still getting better. I don't think that's an illusion. I think I am still getting better. I started as an adult, so I'm not one of these people that started as a little kid, wrecked my body, and then it's downhill from there.
But this is something that you get real joy out of.
I get real joy out.
And so this is like play. This is like an element of,
totally,
of play in your life. So you're
right.
You play your play in your life.
I play with play. I guess at the meta level of play. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the time I'm playing, and whether it's with art or in dance or with yoga. I also do yoga, have for many years, and I play with the edges. I'm always advancing myself as much as I can and learning about how to do that. And that has something to do with what you said earlier about, you know, finding those tiny little places and then working my way in. Because after you've done like 12,000 sun salutations, it's really, it's hard to find something new.
Or joy in
it. Well, as I've switched over from mostly having a yoga practice to mostly doing a dance, having a dance at this point, in, at this stage in my life. Mm-hmm. I may switch back as I keep getting older, but the action for me is in the dance right now. Mm. It's more like cross-training with the yoga and touching home, touching back the foundations and this sort of thing. But the action is in the dance.
Well, it's been great talking with you. I wish we had more time.
Well, it's been great
students.
To talk to you, too. I've said some stuff I've never said before, and that's really fun.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I love when that happens.
Yeah, me too.
So again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tony.
It's been fabulous.